On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
This is Robert Scheer with another edition of our podcast, Scheer Intelligence. I'm here with Ralph Nader, somebody I consider to be the kind of American original I'm trying to profile in this series, product of the different immigration, crazy quilt, cultural, ethnicity, religious backgrounds we have in this country. And Ralph Nader is truly an American original, a person who just transformed the nature of politics as far as reflecting the interests of the average person called a consumer, saved more lives, beginning with his automobile safety crusade and on through his various other campaigns, training a whole generation of new lawyers who, and the Maine defended the public interest and various spin-off organizations. And I'm here with an unusual moment. We're at the Nation Cruise, where a basically liberal left audience is considering the choices in this election between a Bernie Sanders and a Hillary Clinton. And the reason I wanted to talk to Ralph is that I was on a similar cruise with him previously when Barack Obama was first running. And I think stupidly in retrospect, disparaged his advocating an independent path, his concerns about an Obama candidacy co-opting American politics. And I'm here not only to make amends, but to ask Ralph Nader how he views this current election. What's going on, Ralph? I know you probably favor Bernie Sanders, but he's also agreed to support whoever the candidate is of the party. Is this a dead end? Is this meaningful? What's the answer?
Well, that was a mistake he made when he was asked, you know, about the middle of 2015 or maybe in the spring, will you support the Democratic nominee? And he said, I always do. Well, he should have said, it depends who it is. Because the moment he said, I always do, the Clinton forces knew that he will fall in line in April, say, if he loses the primaries to her, Hillary Clinton. And then it'll be, you know, one happy corporate Democratic run to November. The tragedy is that he's going to leave behind millions of very discouraged voters who voted for him. And he will have demonstrated that he did all this effort, raised a lot of good money and small contributions, and got nothing for it in terms of an agenda. Nothing. So what I'm suggesting is that the followers, if you are going to vote for Bernie Sanders in the various state primaries, tell him right from the beginning that he has to condition any support for Hillary on his agenda. He's got to get Hillary very, very specifically to adopt his major agenda in return for his endorsement. If he doesn't do that, it's the same old cycle that you've talked about, where the progressive candidate is folded in, like Dennis Kucinich and others. They're all folded in. They leave all kinds of disheartened voters and followers behind, and the corporate Democrats march all the way to Wall Street.
Well, one of the ironic results of the Obama victory, where I was captivated by the young people turning out for Obama, I was captivated by his ability to raise a number of questions, including criticism of the banking industry and, by implication, criticism of the Democratic Party's support, beginning with Bill Clinton, of the deregulation of the banking industry and so forth. Well, after Hillary dropped out in that race, Barack Obama then actually turned to the very same people, the Timothy Geithners and the Lawrence Summers and so forth, that had constructed the Clinton deregulation and put them in government. And one of the results of the Obama administration, the continuation of the wars, the failure to really hold any of the bankers responsible, is the very disillusionment that you were talking about actually is out there. I mean, I've seen it with the young people that I teach. They certainly don't have enthusiasm for this election that they had for the Obama election. And what I'm wondering about is this sort of interesting, odd, unexpected figure of Bernie Sanders. On the one hand, there's a great educational value to his campaign. You know, he's actually raised the possibility that something called democratic socialism might matter. Certainly on domestic issues, he's had a very principled position of challenging big corporate power that I'm sure you're sympathetic to. But as you suggest, already he's taken that step to betraying, is that, maybe that's too harsh a word, I don't know, but it would seem to me if he just stands up there on the stage holding Hillary's Clinton's leg, and she hasn't changed her position on certain key questions, one of which certainly would be how you treat Wall Street, where she's carried a lot of baggage for Wall Street and taken a lot of money from them, it could have an extremely negative effect.
Yes, I think his ambition is limited. I think he just wants to push the agenda toward progressive politics and then support the Democratic nominee and go back to the Senate where, you know, he has a committee and he's part of the Democratic Party, even though he's technically an independent socialist. So he's very much concerned with not jeopardizing his base in the Senate and his seniority in the Senate. So I don't think he has the ambition to try to overtake her, because he has all kinds of arguments against her. As you know, she's never met a war she didn't like. She's never met a weapon system she didn't like. She is a war hawk, even more than Obama. She overrode Secretary of Defense Gates, who was opposed to toppling the dictator of Libya, and persuaded Obama to remove the dictator of Libya. And the incredible chaos that still is going on, spilling over into Central Africa, killing, sectarian fights. And that's her war. So I call her Hillary the Hawk, or in other moments, when I want to be bilingual, I call her Generalissima Hillary.
And then, or you could call her Margaret Thatcher.
Worse. She's got her hands on more weapons, got her hands on a bigger empire, got her hands on the Bush-Obama past, where no national sovereignty is a barrier to special forces, drones, and other attacks, unconstitutional, illegal, and violating the UN Charter and the Geneva Conventions. Domestically, she's a complete corporatist. I mean, she got two speeches that totaled $500,000 within a couple weeks of themselves by Goldman Sachs. She then goes to at least a dozen giant trade association gatherings, locks the door, that's the condition, gets paid $200,000, $250,000 to tell them what they want to hear, and no one is demanding that she release the tapes. Because I'm sure the car dealers' convention is going to remember the nice things she said about perhaps not regulating them very much. And all those tapes should be disclosed. So she's a Wall Street corporatist, and she's a militarist, and she's running for the Democratic Party, and Bernie Sanders is going to endorse her?
You know Bernie Sanders. You've known him for quite a while, have you?
I knew him before he was mayor of Burlington, and we had some meetings together when I was up in Vermont. But he became a Lone Ranger. Like a lot of progressive senators are Lone Rangers. By that I mean they don't network, they don't connect with the national citizen groups that are progressive, you know, huddle with them the way the Republicans do with the Heritage Foundation or the Cato Institute. And so I haven't gotten a call back from Bernie Sanders in 15 years. I've called him. I've written him. When he went on the floor, remember, he gave that, you know, 15-hour speech that he turned into a book. I wanted to congratulate him. Never returned a call. Never would meet. I think part of it is he's gone a long way without my advice. He's a Lone Ranger. He's been elected by a very conservative Republican state, Vermont, even though he still keeps the title Democratic Socialist. That's quite an achievement. So that can get into a politician a sense of, who needs anybody to give me advice? Well, he's running for president now, and he's got a little tiny staff in Vermont. He does need advice because his delivery is getting a bit tedious. It's not diverse enough, new facts. He should give a speech on the post office. He should give a speech on corporate crime enforcement, a lack of budget for the criminal prosecuting agencies in the U.S. government. But he doesn't do that. That's why I really think he is, in his own mind, his campaign is very limited ambition. It's to push Hillary in a more progressive direction. However, rhetorically, you can't trust her to ever translate her progressive rhetoric into actual record if she gets elected. And he goes back to the Senate. He's got a bigger mailing list. I think he's going to raise $75 million in small contributions. That's never been done before in American political history. And I think that satisfies him.
But isn't it also good for the country to have had a Bernie Sanders have this kind of reach and introduce some new ideas, including the words democratic socialism actually can be American as apple pie, and that these are things. Is there no great educational value to this?
There is, but you know, the public's memory is very short. They can't often remember what somebody said at the presidential level. They can't even remember who was vice presidential candidate. But more to the point is, what he says, he's going to raise expectation levels. And if he folds in with Hillary's campaign without having Hillary endorse publicly, vociferously, and specifically his agenda, he is going to tarnish whatever memory of his good speeches with a sense of that he sold out, that he basically not sold out for money, that he sold out because he wanted to maintain his base in the U.S. Senate. And that can negate any of the good things that he has done educating the public to understand that socialism in the U.S. is American as apple pie. You know that, Bob. You got public electric utilities, about 1,000 of them, owned by the cities, including the Los Angeles Power District, the Tennessee Valley Authority. You got public libraries. You got public schools. You got public transit. You got the public post office. In some conservative states, you have public state-owned liquor stores, like in New Hampshire. In conservative Nebraska, the utility is publicly owned, the electric utility. And of course, he mentioned Social Security and Medicare. So that's a very good thing he's done. But as I say, it can be completely overwhelmed by disillusionment if he folds without conditioning the wishes of millions of his voters by telling Hillary no endorsement without adopting this agenda, which she should adopt because there's majority support. It's a vote-getter for her.
What would the agenda be?
The agenda would be, one, breaking up the banks, the big New York banks. The second would be expanding Social Security. The third is full Medicare for all, everybody in, nobody out. Free choice of doctor and hospital, which we don't have today. And it's half as expensive per capita. That's the experience in Canada. They cover everybody with half as much dollars per capita. It would be expanding public works. We used to call it public works. That means more modern public transit, expanding Amtrak, expanding city transit systems, upgrade sewage, water systems, repair schools, a huge jobs program, good pay, that can't be exported to countries like China. And he's serious about that. It includes corporate tax reform. I think he would do something about these tax havens. And I think it would also include a lot of criminal justice reform. He's not really talking that much about that, but I think he would be a force for reforming the drug law and emptying out a lot of nonviolent prisoners from our jails, leaving enough space for enhanced prosecution of corporate crooks who would take their place.
Yeah, and there are some Republican candidates, and there's some sentiment certainly on the libertarian side of the Republican for prison reform. Even the Koch brothers have come out for that.
Yeah.
And generally what will happen, Hillary Clinton, he probably will not propose that, and even if he does, she's not going to do this. And then we're going to once again, for most of the people who've been listening to you on the Nation cruise, who are liberal and somewhat on the left, they'll go for the lesser evil. And I recall when Jerry Brown, who's actually in California sending a much better model for the Democratic Party on a number of issues, but I remember when he was running against Bill Clinton in the primary, he said, this is not a choice of the lesser of two evils, it's the evil of two lessers. And that's an interesting concept here. People will be traumatized by the idea of one of those Republicans getting in, unless and probably it's some more establishment person like a Jeb Bush who will then move more to the center and you'll have...
Well, it's more than an interesting concept. It's the ultimate trap of American politics, where the Democrat voters will support anybody who's not as bad as the Republican nominee. And so they judge the Democratic Party, which is dominated by the corporate Democrats, by how bad the Republicans are, instead by how much better the Democrats can be. And there's no end to that trap. If you've seen a lot of four-year cycles, every 4 years both parties move to the right. Every 4 years the corporate influence is greater. Every 4 years as the Democrats move to the right, it gives the Republicans more elbow room to become even more reactionary. And nobody who chooses the lesser of two evils or the evil of two lessers ever will answer this question. What is your breaking point? What's your moral compass? They can't answer it because there is no breaking point. There will always be the two major parties. Here's why we don't have a democracy in an electoral sense, Bob. One, we have money is all important, corrupting people's voters. Number two, gerrymandering means that the politicians will pick their voters. I mean, imagine anything less democratic than that. And both Democrat and Republicans do that depending on who runs the state government. And number three, they block competition. They are a duopoly. They would be indicted for violation of the antitrust laws if there are two companies. And they're blocking the ability of third parties to get a foothold and grow from 4 years to 4 years or 2 years to 2 years at the state and local level at a level unheard of in Western countries. It is harder to get on the ballot in North Carolina as a presidential candidate than to get on the ballot on six European countries. And that once you add the absurdity of the Electoral College, where you can come in second in a popular vote and be president, you add this winner-take-all so that the Green Party, even if it got 48% of the vote, it would lose. Whereas in Germany, if it breaks the 5% of the vote, it gets 5% of the parliament. If it goes to 10%, it gets 10% of the parliament. So you see, it can grow from one election to another.
So how do we get out of this trap?
Here's how we'd get out of it. First, you get rid of the Electoral College. That means that a presidential campaign will have to campaign in all the states. Right now, 40 states are either slam dunk Republican, like Texas, or slam dunk Democrat, like Massachusetts. So they don't have to campaign in those states. That's one. The second is, you say, well, who can get rid of big money in politics? It's Congress, all right? So that goes to my second point. 1% or less active people in every congressional district connecting one another, anteing up some money for full-time office in each congressional district with three or four full-time people can turn Congress around on this. Why? Because it reflects majority opinion. Believe it or not, both left, right think it stinks, that money corrupts and it stinks. So once you have majority opinion behind you, you can get Congress changed. We've got to stop thinking it's insurmountable, this you can't fight City Hall, you can't fight Exxon, you can't change everything. The moment people exaggerate the power of the opposition, they're depowering themselves by definition. They're turning themselves into even more powerless things. Well, and the third thing that can be done to break the two-party is start locally. Because locally, you know, Bob, there are often city councils where nobody runs against the incumbents because it's not a two-party. They don't even have a two-party system, Democrat, Republican, Board of Education. That's where you can really start. The Tea Party was smart. They started a lot at the local level, and then they went to Congress.
I'm talking to Ralph Nader. This is Bob Scheer. Let me ask you a question about the demonization of the others. You know, we're actually doing this interview on a cruise of left liberals from the responded to Nation magazine's appeal. But here, more, if you mention the Koch brothers, you mention the Republican, well, they're the devil incarnate. You know, I look at the Koch brothers, you know, they have their different positions. But, you know, are they really the worst than Goldman Sachs and, you know, and all the other firms that will probably go quite enthusiastically for Hillary Clinton? And so what is the message here? How do we begin to think clearly about what's going on in our politics?
Well, the message is there are two entities in the United States. One are human beings and the other is the corporate entity. And it's no contest. Because corporations have privileges and immunities that we'll never have, even individual billionaires will never have. I mean, we just stopped by in the Grand Cayman Islands where one office building had 10,000 corporate tax avoiders registered. And, you know, for example, Citigroup has maybe a dozen subsidiaries. They can create their own children, right, which most individuals can't do with abandon, you know, all over the world, with hundreds of subsidiaries. They can create their own parents called holding companies to evade certain regulations and certain jurisdictions. By the same token, they have all the rights we have. So my point is, we got to create a double standard that only people have certain constitutional rights, because it starts out the preamble, we the people, not we the corporation, right? And that corporations as such, not their employees, as such, should not be allowed to give money to campaigns, should not be allowed to lobby, and should not be allowed to testify in the corporate name, because they're not human beings. And so I call this subordination. Subordinate the corporate entity constitutionally to the supremacy, the sovereignty of the people, as our founders envisioned. The word company, corporation, or political parties doesn't even exist in the Constitution. Why do they run us? Why do they rule us? The second change is already underway. Tens of billions of consumer dollars are building the local economies. They're farmer, you know, to consumer marketplaces. They're local renewable energy. They're credit unions. They're community banks. They're community health clinics, on and on. And Yes Magazine chronicles this out of Seattle. And every time people spend money in the local economy, they're taking money away from the Bank of America, Exxon, you know, the big guys. And it's already tens of billions, but that's what I call displacement. So you displace these giant multinational corporations that have no allegiance to any community or any country. They go wherever they can control the government and make the most profit. You displace them at the local economy level, and you subordinate them legally so that people have greater constitutional rights than this legal fiction called the multinational corporation.
But now we're going to go into this election, Ralph Nader, yeah. And people are going to say Hillary Clinton has said she's against Citizens United, and she more likely will appoint people to the Supreme Court who would reverse it. And that's, again, people can say, you know, what Ralph Nader said on that podcast is quite interesting, but you vote for Hillary, you'll get somebody appointed to the court that will reverse that decision. Vote for the Republicans, they won't do that.
Well, let's say they do reverse Citizens United. It was pretty bad before Citizens United, 2010. Before 2010, money ruled too. You know, the big corporate executives gave money. They had all kinds of loopholes to give to the Democratic committees, but not to the, you know, not to the candidates, to get over the minimal level that individual can give to each political candidate. It was a terrible situation. If anything, Citizens United woke up the country. You know, they went to the final step of basically saying corporations can spend as much money as they want to elect or defeat a local, state, or national candidate in the United States of America. I mean, you can't get any worse than that, because I think the 2016 election may cost $7, $8 billion. Everything, Congress, presidency. I mean, that's like a fourth of Exxon's profits, post-tax, such as it is. So, you know, the Supreme Court, I have never advocated the impeachment of any member of the Supreme Court. until they pass Citizens United.
Okay, but somebody listening to this will say, yeah. You know, Ralph Nader, you just made the case for a vote for Hillary, because she will appoint judges who are will probably reverse Citizens United.
But it's nowhere near enough. If they go back to where it was in 2009, 2008, it was terrible. There were all kinds of books saying how primaries were corrupted by money. This one just opened up all the spigots. And actually, it might lead to a backfire. But our country needs so many reforms and changes that we just can't focus everything on Citizens United. You know, sometimes liberals get trapped, like the women's rights movement got trapped by the ERA. I mean, it sucked the oxygen out of that women all over the country paid more than men for a lot of things. They got unnecessary operations because it was a male-dominated medical system. They had to pay more for auto purchases. They were discriminated against in terms of credit. But it was all ERA, ERA, ERA. The same trap can be the future of progressive movements if you just focus on Citizens United. That's a tidbit compared to the subordination of the entire corporate structure constitutionally to the supremacy of the people.
50 years ago, you took on the most powerful industry in America, the automobile industry, celebrated by people with the most massive advertising mechanism. They defined American culture. I mean, it would be, I don't think, an exaggeration to say that most people in America even define freedom and quality of life and the ability to move and status by their car. And you challenged those very idols. You challenged those tokens. You said, no, they should not be worshipped, the big car, the fuel-efficient car, the unsafe car. No, we have to challenge that. And you defeated this incredibly powerful industry, okay? And how old were you then?
32.
32-year-old guy comes along, writes a book, Unsafe at Any Speed, and within 9 months you get legislation passed, and we now accept as normal that cars should be safe.
Yeah.
And as a result, we've had a tremendous decline in highway deaths and everything else.
Yeah,
okay?
Over 3.5 million lives saved.
Right. So there's the 32-year-old Ralph Nader, and now I'm talking to you as, what, 82 years old, right?
81.
81 years old, Ralph Nader. We're sitting here, and probably enough in a thing where they play cards on a cruise ship. How would you assess this 50-year period? Where are we now?
My only support were the American people, and they took all these wins we got for granted and sat by while corporations beefed up their lobbyists, beefed up their campaign money, beefed up their media, and took over Washington. Washington is corporate-occupied territory. It didn't have to be. My main message to people is don't get discouraged, because American history shows 1% or less active people in congressional districts representing you, majority opinion, can turn around the Congress and defeat these corporations again and again and again. If they want to get my column free, just go to Nader.org, and they'll get a weekly column free, 7 minutes of agitation, if you're a moderate reader, every week. That often tells you what can be done. And so we can overcome this demoralization of so many good people in this country.
We have a few minutes left. I want you to really look at this trajectory. And first of all, let's talk about, quickly summarize the accomplishments, because this was, a revolutionary change in America, the assertion of this consumer interest, the challenge to big corporates, that a 32-year-old young lawyer, 32-year young lawyer, managed to pull off. And there were others. Why don't you first give us a list of those victories?
Yeah, it was that critical period, 1966 to 1974, when the main environmental laws were passed, the consumer product safety, auto safety laws were passed, the Great Freedom of Information Act was passed in 1974. Even Nixon signed into law the Occupational Safety and Health Law.
The Environmental Protection Act.
The Environmental Protection Act. He would have gone further if the Democrats didn't block him. He wanted the right to vote for members of Congress by the District of Columbia residents. He had a health plan, insurance plan, better than Clinton offered years later. He even had a minimum incomes plan that was devised and supported by Monroe, by Milton Friedman and Daniel P. Moynihan, who was assistant to Nixon, to start rolling back poverty. And the Congress blocked it. And then the decline really started. And
well, let's stop for that moment, yeah. Francis, because this is a history people don't know.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, Nixon also did a surprising thing in going to China and taking the wind out of the Cold War. But let's talk about that domestic, because Nixon has been demonized, and we had Watergate. But let's talk about this critical moment. In 66, you write a book, right, Unsafe and High Speed, and really—
In 65.
65, yeah. And it really fuels— adds tremendous energy to a consumer movement. And then an improbable president, Richard Nixon, actually builds on some of this stuff. And how do we get and from there to today?
Well, Nixon was the last Republican to be afraid of liberals. He was afraid of the rumble from the people coming out of the tumultuous 60s that spilled over into the early 70s, and that's why he would sign these bills, along with the ones that Lyndon Johnson signed. But once the rumble of the people diminished, and once the corporate media started blocking the kind of coverage we got, we couldn't have done a lot of what we did. But we had some reporters who covered us day after day, and columnist Drew Pearson, the Washington Post, Martin Menz, the New York Times, Walter Rugaber in Detroit on auto safety, the great reporter Pat Sloyan, UPI. They don't do that anymore. They're all looking for Pulitzer Prizes. You know, they want one big feature. You got to follow the struggle in Congress, you know, week after week. And we don't have that. So we have to rebuild it. And my view of rebuilding it is to get people to think, am I going to be one of the 1% reflecting majority opinion that's going to roll up my sleeves with people in my congressional district, and I'm going to be responsible for my two senators and representative, along with several thousand other people in each congressional district. You know, I think people should take Congress personally. People delegate their power under the Constitution to 535 members of Congress, representatives and senators, and a majority of these people have sold it to Wall Street, have sold it to the corporations, and they have allowed the corporations to turn our government through the Congress against its own people. Now, I think people should get angry at that.
Thank you, Ralph Nader. This has been a terrific conversation with a true American original, and people should check out your column. We also run it on Truth Dig every week.
Okay, that's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. Thanks to Ralph Nader, and thanks as well to producers Joshua Shear and Rebecca Mooney, and to engineers Mario Diaz and Kat Yore for making me sound good. Until next time, this is Bob Shear and Shear Intelligence from KCRW.